I want to welcome everybody to the first of six engagement and learning telelearning sessions sponsored by the Canadian Social Economy Hub and the Steering Committee for the 2010 National Summit on People-Centered Economy. My name is Seth Asimakis, and I am the General Manager of the St. John Community Loan Fund. I'm also a Executive Director with the Canadian Community Investment Network Cooperative and a co-director with the Atlantic Social Economy Node, so part of that hub of research in the Atlantic region. The Canadian Social Economy Hub is a national social economy research program that is co-led by the University of Victoria and the Canadian CED Network. It involves practitioner organizations and universities across Canada with a national hub and six regional centers in different parts of the country. Through funding from the federal government, through SHRC, or the Social Science and Humanities Research Council, research is being undertaken to understand how the approaches of the social economy can be better understood and effectively applied to that to community organizations, civil society, community developers, and researchers, so that they can collaborate to empower groups and communities to meet their social and economy needs. Of course, we're in the fifth year, the final year of that research program, and involved in quite a bit of dissemination this final year. This session is based on two papers under the theme of social capital financing. The papers are the National Summit issue paper by Jessica Notwell from the Women's Economic Council, Tim Drayman, Joanna Reynolds, and Mira Katz from Causeway. And the second is the CSERP knowledge paper financing the social economy by George Karafilis, and I should say George primarily, and me very little. The objective of this series is to generate engagement and learning about key issues within Canada, to share results, and to build momentum leading up to the national summit. You all received, I think, the PDF that shows you some of the other learning events that are going to be coming up. They look really good, and I'm glad that that this partnership is enabling this type of a program. There's going to be a chat room that we are running concurrently with the phone call. And if you have access to a computer, internet, you can visit the link that's on the email, I believe. And if you have a problem, let me know, or Rochelle, via email, I guess. And what we'll do is periodically look at those and hopefully pull a question or two off the chat room. The chat room will continue on post-event, and will be monitored, and we'll continue to hopefully send some information out to participants. So we're trying to use the full gamut of media here, and hopefully it works. So the speakers today are George Karafilis from Cape Breton, from the Community Economic Development Institute at the Cape Breton University, the Shannon School of Business, as it's called. And he's been George's been involved in quite a bit of research around CED, and has been quite involved specifically with the social economy research node in the Atlantic region, looking at financing the social economy. During this session, he'll discuss his research that outlines the challenges facing social economy organizations that pursue external financing. So, looking forward to that. And I think what we will do is proceed right from there to get George into speaking mode, and then I'll introduce the next speaker after that. Okay? So, George, are you ready to go?
Yes.
Okay. The floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Seth. We started this research study a couple of years ago, and Seth and Peter Huff were the community partners, so they steered us on what the needs were, what kind of data we needed. So the first phase was to actually survey the demand for external financing from all the social economy organizations in Atlantic Canada. And the second phase, it was to look at the supply, you know, how the financiers, the foundations, the banks, the credit unions, and the governments, how do they finance the social economy. So that's basically how we did it. So it took a little bit of time because there were two phases involved. So we're looking at both the demand and the supply. That was the key feature of our study, that we'll try to do both sides. Typically, studies in the past have only done one side. So that's what we try to do. So the first thing was to come up with a sample in the first phase of who we're going to include in the social economy sample, for the organizations we're going to include. And basically, we've used the criteria used by the Quebec social economy chair, researcher of the social economy, and basically we used their criteria. They use four criteria to determine if participation is in the social economy, and basically that's what we used. Now the criteria had them in our paper, and there's a nice diagram that I didn't have in this summary, but there's a nice diagram that shows the four dimensions. But basically, the organization has to have some economic activity. They must be providing some kind of a service or a good for compensation. They must have a limited distribution of surpluses to members. It must be a voluntary association with legal and decisional autonomy, which basically means not a government agency. It has to be something that that's open to people. And it has to show democratic governance. So those are the four criteria. That's basically what we used. And then we tried to do five areas only, so that way we'll know that we enumerated all the big social economy organizations in these areas. So we did St. John, New Brunswick, because Seth is there and he will help us. We did Cape Breton, of course, because that's where we're based. We did the Halifax Regional Municipality to make sure we have a nice urban sample. We did Newfoundland and Prince Edward Island. So that's basically the sample we used, five areas. Now, in all of Atlantic Canada, there's 13,000 incorporated organizations in the economy and registered charities, and the revenue is about $5.7 billion a year. After we did our enumeration in those five areas, we came up with a list of 5,036 organizations, and we applied the four criteria, and we brought the list down to 1,142, and we sent those surveys out, and we received back 281 surveys, and we had self-screen questions on the surveys, and so that list pared down a little bit more. So at the end, we had 207 surveys that met all the criteria. And so that was a pretty good, because we had more than 200 surveys. That was the big thing. Now, what do we find from this demand side? Well, we found the rejection was kind of high, 42%. But at the same time, we found a large percentage of the social economy organizations plan to expand, like a 42% also plan to expand. So that was good to see. And a large percentage are looking for more than $500,000 for expansion. Those were the key things. And the other key thing was that there's a heavy reliance on grants, on government grants. The 60% of the social economy organizations received grants in the previous 12 months. On the supply side, we went through those five areas again that we had, and we looked at who was there to finance enterprises and charities and all that stuff in those areas. There were 224 branches of financial institutions, government agencies, and foundations that we found, and we managed to get 61 surveys completed, and that basically trying to find out what was problematic. So, I'm not going to go through all the results because that will take a long time, and Seth knows about that. So what I'll do is I'm just going to go straight into our policy recommendations, and I'll tie them into our results. So the first policy recommendation that we're making, and that's from the paper that was provided as a resource on the website, is that we realize that the majority of the social economy organizations need to pursue commercial activity, and they need to get external finance to be able to grow. But the organizational form that they're using right now, the legal form that they use, makes this very difficult. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I think another speaker will pick on that also. But this has been an issue now that kind of hot. It was even the Global Mail listed, mentioned the Global Mail 2 weeks ago. And apparently Revenue Canada is looking into this. Basically, the idea of adapting the British, the UK CIC forum, the Community Interest Company, or the United States L3 forum. And that will allow to make sure that social economy organizations are able to be charities and at the same time to be able to carry on a business. And that has been very problematic to do in Canada. It requires complex structures, usually with a charity and a foundation, and then another branch to do the business. So it's kind of problematic and expensive to do. So that's the first research finding that we found. And the key to that one is that most SEOs that are doing some kind of an enterprise right now, enterprise activity, they're doing this as a project within the SEO, and they're probably violating the law without knowing. But anyway, that's the first finding. The second finding is that there is a huge obstacle if you try to start up in social economy, in trying to access capital. Social economy startups are facing major obstacles in accessing capital. As I mentioned, the rejection rate is 42%, which is double, basically, what the small businesses experience. All the surveys on small business financing come up with a figure of around 25% failure rate. And the one in the social economy is, in our sample, was 42%. Now, on the financier side, when we survey the financiers, the banks, the credit unions, and the foundations and all that, what they mentioned as problematic on the social economy applications, it was the heavy reliance on grants, and they didn't know if the grants are going to continue from year to year, and the lack of security. Like in small business financing, there is personal guarantees, and there is collateral. And the other problem, of course, was there was no personal equity and low profitability. Those were the top factors mentioned by the financiers, the banks and the credit unions, as being problematic in social economy startups. And the big problem is, especially when you're looking for financing over $100,000, that seemed to be a major gap there. But for smaller financings, somehow it was a little bit more possible, especially if you go through a CBDC. In Atlantic Canada, the CBDCs have a mandate to help social economy organizations. So for finances under $100,000 in Atlantic Canada has been okay, so to speak, for the most part, but it has been a big problem for financings over $100,000. Quebec has a good ecology in this sector, as you all know, and they do have a fund called the RISC Fund, R-I-S-Q, and that has $10 million in it, and we specialize in doing startups in the social economy. So the recommendation that we have for policy is for different levels of government to come up with a social economy, a loan guarantee program, similar to what they have for small businesses, but the CSBF, where the personal guarantee is not as important. With this kind of a loan guarantee program, the government steps in, and the personal guarantee handicap that the social economy organizations have doesn't become a problem. Another policy recommendation is to come up with tax incentives for corporations and investors, not just small investors, not for consumers, so to speak, for retail investors, but to come up with big tax incentives, exploration style, like the ones that are given to junior exploration companies this type of incentives for mutual funds or corporate investors that want to invest in social economy enterprises. The third recommendation is to consider doing something like the Community Reinvestment Act that exists in the state, something like that. And another recommendation was to come up with an electronic registration for community issues of debt or equity, so that way those things can be traded. So basically, to allow the financial instruments for the social economy to move on to a secondary market. So that was the second recommendation, the second research finding, the problematic startup. The third research finding is that doing expansions, they require a lot of money. Like 42% of the SEOs in Atlantic Canada said they plan an expansion, and a quarter of those, they said they need more than $500,000 for the expansion. Obviously, this is problematic. Only 11% of our sample has ever been able to raise this kind of money, over $500,000. So what recommendations we make for that one? Well, for one thing was to come up with patient capital regional pools to provide some kind of stability with some partial government capital guarantee. And that will entice investors to invest in those. And that could be more like a bond fund, something we have a small kind of coupon interest rate, and it will have some government capital guarantee, so like 20% or something to that effect. They have tried those in other jurisdictions, in other parts of the world, and they seem to work because people understand bonds better. And that fund then will make loans to a social enterprise that are looking for expansion. Then the second recommendation is to try to do what they've done in Quebec, where the labor unions actually became partners in setting up those funds. That's not possible everywhere, but it might work in some jurisdictions. And the third recommendation related to this is that try to take the CDIFs that are in Nova Scotia, the Community Economic Development Investment Funds, and try to duplicate, replicate that kind of legislation across Canada. They allow for a very low cost, very low administration issue of equity, not debt, it's equity, and they're RRSP eligible automatically. This is beautiful legislation in Nova Scotia, and a few social economy organizations have taken advantage of that, and they've been able to raise quite a bit of money that way.
George, I just wanted to interrupt. We're at an hour and 20 minutes, so I'm wondering if you can wrap up.
It is the last recommendation is the community organizations have low financial management expertise, according to the financiers, and according to financiers, they submit incomplete business plans. Basically, the recommendation is the last one is that we come up with capacity building programs, just like they have in Quebec, the CSMO and ESAC, and provide government support for financing proof of concept, basically projects.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, George. I'm going to do something a bit different. I want to make sure we get all the speakers in, and we'll do maybe 12, 13 minutes each one. I know we were setting 10 minutes, but we do have three. And I'm going to move right to Miri Katz, who will be the next speaker. She's an associate with Social Innovation Generation, or SIG, National, and an organization focused on fostering social innovation, focused on creativity, social innovations, tackling social environmental challenges faced by Canadians. I guess she has a master's in industrial relations in HR from the University of Toronto and has a degree, a business admin degree. She's previously worked at an international charity developing target markets and awareness building for the organization as consultant organizations in the HR and so on. So she's part of one of the quite an innovative organization based in Toronto, and I'm going to turn it over to Miri right now so that she can introduce their paper. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Seth, and good morning and good afternoon to everyone. I actually found George's paper and research very interesting, and it's very much in line with my brief talk. I'm just going to do a sort of an intro to social finance, and then hand it over to Jessica Notwell. So first, I just want to say thank you very much for letting me be on this call and to talk about social finance, what it is, why it's important, the current challenges that we're facing, and some policy recommendations. I just wanted to also extend Tim Draymond's regrets for not being on the call today. He and a few of our Mars delegates are in Oxford, England at the Skoll World Forum, which is dedicated to discussing social entrepreneurship, with this year's theme being catalyzing collaboration for large-scale change. And I think that's actually quite timely for what we need to do in moving social finance and for your upcoming People-Centered Summit and the role and support for social entrepreneurs who are facing the many challenges, one of which is financing their projects and programs. So what is social finance? From a very high level, social finance looks at financing that, besides seeking a bottom line, as is most evident in for-profit institutions, is also seeking a social or environmental bottom line. It looks at various financial tools, such as loans and debt financing available, to leverage existing capital and attract new investment for public benefit. At SIG, we often like to highlight a key global example of social finance, and we usually cite Muhammad Yunus and his Nobel Prize-winning idea developed in Bangladesh. The premise was to provide poor people small loans so that they would be able to develop small-scale businesses, and by doing so, enable them to improve their financial circumstances and help lift them out of poverty. This idea has been in development for over 30 years, and there are now over 93 million people around the world who have been benefited from these loans through microfinancing. So you can start to see why social finance is important. And I'd just like to give a little bit of a brief landscape in Canada, although George did a really great job of that. It's social finance is still in an emergent stage here, and it's less evolved versus our UK and US counterparts. And we're currently still accessing finance from traditional avenues, such as government and philanthropic organizations. And they're getting two sources of income, either through charitable donations or grants or contributions from governments. But the problem is an incredible thing that the Canadian nonprofit sector is very much economically significant, and it's growing. It currently represents $120 billion in annual expenditures, which is more than Canada's retail, mining, or oil gas sectors. And there are over 161,000 registered charities and nonprofit organizations. And these organizations employ about 2 million people, which is about 7.2% of Canada's labor force. So these organizations have very large scale ambitions, meaning that these sources of funding will not be able to sustain them. And I think George mentioned that earlier. So that means that new sources of capital are critical to their ability to innovate, scale up successful solutions, and extend their services and programs, and more importantly, to impact society. So this is actually what I find very interesting is that George's recommendations are very similar and in line with our recommendations, and also with the challenges that we have heard from convening and going on various study tours at SIG. And some of the things that we've have found was that these organizations, again, they need new sources of capital, but the issue is the current infrastructure here in Canada. So current federal tax law and regulations with respect to the charities and non-charitable nonprofit organizations are unnecessarily restrictive, and they actually serve an obstacle for greater innovation in entrepreneurship. And I just wanted to say that right now we have no National Charities Act, And another thing that we're limited in is our federal and provincial nonprofit corporation laws, and they don't permit any new hybrid corporate structures, which are sort of coming into fruition in the U.S. and the U.K. The Canada Corporations Act actually has not been changed since 1917, so we have to actually make inroads in that. The other thing is within the program-related investments, foundations here in Canada can only make program-related investments into charities and not into social enterprises, which also affects that limitation. The other thing that we found was that there's an absence of dedicated intermediary financial institutions, and also them being there's also a lack of mature intermediaries, and it makes it difficult to lower the barriers for prospective investors. Financial intermediaries have a very important role in creating a smooth investment process, and these people include those who can provide a corporate finance role to assist in the management of contracts and consortium building. And we also found that there's a relatively untapped stakeholder group, which are the institutional investors, so those with involved in the pension plans and mutual funds, but have a social responsible investment strategy, as well as the private sector partnership. And these investors are looking to invest in these organizations, but again, because of all these various stipulations and the legal framework, they find it very challenging. The other thing that they're having difficulty with is there is no group out there that's doing the due diligence on the risk and return assessment. And it's very difficult for them to do that on their own just because it causes excessive transaction costs for them. And Causeway, we actually had a lot of what we do is convening, and we've had several thought leaders about this, and we had with various other people started to talk about the idea of various proposed funding structures. And just a caveat, not any one of these funding structures is the end all. I think it's something that has to be sort of done together global level, but I'm just going to give you a list of them. There's the these are just proposals. Loan and investment fund, and it's a model that's used after the nonprofit finance fund in the U.S. And the fund seeks to provide working capital and bridge loans to nonprofits and charitable organizations. It will be using private sector banks and philanthropic capital, and the fund will act as an intermediary, providing access to capital for organizations that traditionally have had a difficult time in securing financing loans and financing. And it will also work with nonprofits to build financial capacity. The second one is the community investment vehicle. It is a way, it's a product to channel investment dollars from individuals and institutional investors. It's invested nationally in revenue-generating social enterprises owned and operated by nonprofits. Then we have the fund-to-fund product. And basically, it's a fund that would invest in underlying pool of socially responsible funds. It will allow investors to get access to socially responsible investment opportunities in a cost-efficient manner. And social venture fund, which is the fourth one, is basically set up to encourage social innovation and fund social entrepreneurs. And it's basically targeted for early stage social ventures with strong potential to scale. And lastly, we have the program related investment fund. And the idea is to have a challenge or campaign, which is proposed to raise capital within the foundation community for a notional fund that could catalyze creation of new financial products serving the mission-based investing market, and would focus on private and community foundations, such as corporate foundations and even government, and could be drawn in as providers for first loss capital. So now I'm just going to turn over, I guess, back to Seth and Jessica. Thank you very much.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much, Mary. Jessica Notwell is going to speak next and following those comments. She's the manager of the Women's Economic Council and also serves in a fairly prominent role as vice president of the World YWCA board, and in that capacity is the liaison co-chair of the International Cooperation Committee, also the board liaison on integrating of the integrating committee and overseer in support of the peer support system, and coordinates the national board understanding of the history and future of collaborative work within the membership. So that's really neat. I like the why. So I'll turn it over to Jessica.
Thank you, Seth. Thanks. And I will try to streamline what I'm saying so that I don't repeat anything that George talked about earlier or that Mary talked about either, to try to use people's time most effectively. What I'll do is I'll just start, just for people who aren't as familiar with the situation in Quebec and why it's such an incredible example of best practices, I'm just going to give you a brief overview and then talk about some recommendations in the Canadian context based on the learning from what's happening in Quebec. So in 1996, there was a summit in Quebec of Quebec's main social economy stakeholders. And in Quebec, the situation before 1996, there were many, many more challenges for the social economy. And so that was recognized at that summit, that there was a need to establish a comprehensive finance sector for the development of the social economy movement in the province. And this is often referred to now as the responsible investment sector or responsible investment architecture. And responsible investment organizations are different from conventional financial institutions, as Mary and George both alluded to, because they also pursue social goals. So they have socioeconomic goals. It's not just one-dimensional. And in Quebec, there's really two broad groups of these kinds of organizations: development capital organizations and solidarity finance organizations. And then they sometimes talk about a third category being a development capital or solidarity finance organization where the funds are supplied by the state. But really those are the two main categories. So in terms of development capital organizations, and in the U.S. these are often called economically targeted investment, just for people who are referring back and forth, they use venture capital instruments to obtain financial yield and achieve social, economic, and environmental objectives, and impose social criteria on the businesses in which they invest, and things that we talk about all the time in the sector, right? So local development, job creation, worker training, environmental protection. And they can take multiple forms, so it could be capital shares, it could be collective or traditional loans. And often in development capital, agencies don't invest directly in the social economy, but establish effective partnerships with those who do. So it's a bit more distinct from direct investment. An example in Quebec is the Fonds de Solidarité, and they protect workers' retirement income while stimulating Quebec's economy through investments. In total, they've invested $4.1 billion in the Quebec economy and created 126,135 jobs, created or maintained those jobs. And they have invested quite heavily in the Chantier, for people who are familiar with the Chantier. And then in turn, the Chantier has been able to create over 524 jobs since July of 2007. So it's an investment and a reinvestment in the community, and it's also, as we know from community investment generally, it has the ability to grow and multiply, and those impacts are sustained over time and grow over time. In terms of solidarity finance, the other mechanism, in the U.S. and Great Britain, it's often referred to as community investment. And the institutions specializing in this area are known as community development financial institutions. So it's direct finance of CED or social economy enterprises. It's governed by actors within the sector, and it uses a variety of different financial instruments, but the clientele are mainly collective enterprises and disadvantaged groups, so really right into the sector. One of the reasons that Quebec has been so incredibly successful in what they've done is that the responsible investment architecture is represented by a diverse group of actors working toward socioeconomic development of the province. So the federal and provincial governments, labor unions, as George talked about, private investors, and social economy enterprises and networks, all working together toward the same goals. So this collaboration and co-construction model is a really important piece of what has led to such success. The partnerships are really important because they've allowed pooling of capital for more and larger investments. They divide risk, and because risk is such a huge red flag for investors, that's been really important. But they also allow the sharing of knowledge and expertise and effective practices. So learning from the example in Quebec then, we thought about what are some of the recommendations we can make for the Canadian context. And Mary and George have certainly gone over a number of really great policy recommendations, so I'll try not to duplicate. One of the recommendations that we talked about was implementing an appropriate regulatory tax and capacity building measures for the social economy sector. And this includes a number of different examples, some of which have been mentioned. So one would be a federal cooperative investment plan, as well as capital development funds for cooperatives and nonprofits. So starting to look more specifically at some of those structures. Coordinated and sustainable government support for CED. So really looking at how can the different levels of government collaborate and make the environment more conducive. Development of a national network of community development and neighborhood renewal corporations. So again, that liaising, learning from the piece about collaboration and co-construction, liaising with one another in terms of investors, but also taking direction from social economy actors themselves. The development of a social enterprise trust. Implementation of a federal procurement strategy to maximize environmental, economic, and social benefits of that procurement at the federal government level, which would, of course, then increase the interaction between the federal government and the social economy in terms of procurement. And George mentioned this as well, that the Government of Canada enact a Community Enterprise Act, which draws upon the best of recent legislative innovations in the UK and the US. The recommendations around this really are for new legislation enabling the creation of a legal structure specifically for the purpose of social enterprise. And as was mentioned, social enterprise and community enterprise aren't actually legal expressions in Canada. They don't actually exist legally as their own entity. And so, as you know, social enterprises in Canada adopt many forms that do fit within the legislation, but they don't necessarily fit so well with the concept of social enterprise. So the Community Enterprise Act would enable new or existing organizations to incorporate as community enterprises, that would be a category of incorporation, with the capacity to share, to issue shares to investors, and a capital lock to ensure that their assets remain primarily for community benefit, so that there would be that guarantee that the community benefit piece stayed around community enterprises. And specific legislative authority be granted to charitable foundations to invest in community enterprises and other organizations that meet this community benefit test, which would also be developed, the community benefit test. So it would really look at creating this new category to allow social enterprises to interact in the marketplace differently. And both Marian and George talked a little bit about some of the other elements. The third recommendation was to recognize the unique economic situation of underserved communities and organizations serving those underserved communities. So organizations, social economy organizations specifically serving women, youth, newcomers, Aboriginal Canadians, and ensure that when policies are implemented that there's some analysis done to ensure that it's not detrimental to these special or target populations when the policies are written. So one piece of that would be respecting and internalizing in policy and programs Aboriginal worldviews and all their diversity, and engaging Aboriginal people in decision making. And again, under that concept of collaboration and co-construction, engaging people in communities and engaging social economy actors when policy and programs are developed. gender analysis of every dollar spent to ensure effective and equitable support for women's employment and economic security, and funding support for holistic programming that includes a continuum of employment and pre-employment services, again, looking at the lived realities of particular populations of Canadians. So have that built right into the policy development process, not in the back end later go back and say, oh, well, we developed a policy, but it didn't do this and this and this, but have it built right in that that analysis happens and that that collaboration happens while policies are being developed. The fourth recommendation is to develop a Canadian anti-poverty strategy with targets, timetables, and resources that includes investment in the social economy and women-centered CED. So although it doesn't sound as much like an investment sort of policy, what this recommendation would do is ensure that that investment happens as part of a larger anti-poverty strategy, which is one more way to ensure that the investment continues to happen even when other things in the environment change. And an example of this would be the recommendation that was in the alternative federal budget in 2009 that talked about investing 1% of the overall federal budget in a national housing strategy.
How much is poverty reduction paying?
And as we know, the economic benefit of investing in housing is that for every job created in the building process, an additional 3 jobs are created at the local level, and for every dollar in rental income generated, over $2 of economic activity happens again in local economy. So there's certainly ways to draw specific.
Could we tell whoever's making all that racket to put their phone on mute? Somebody's talking. I can't hear properly. Maybe they got it. Thank you.
And just the fifth recommendation is to develop, implement, and sustain a national, universal, accessible, and affordable quality child care program. And again, the link back in terms of financing is that research tells us that investment in this kind of program provides 2-to-1 economic returns. And an analysis of Quebec's program indicates that 40 cents out of every dollar invested in child care services is returned to the economy in taxes. And then that money, again, that's returned to the economy in taxes could be reinvested in the social economy. So we can not only look at specific policy changes around investment, but also changes that would create greater revenue through social infrastructure and socially conscious sorts of measures to reinvest then in terms of social economy actors. So those are our recommendations.
Great. Thanks, Jessica. I would like to open it up to questions. I do notice on the chat room that there's been some discussions. They're not specifically a question, but discussion around the forms that we could develop as an incorporated body, the legal structure. And Stacey Corvo, I know, put something on there because she's been working on this for a while. I don't know, Stacey, did you want to comment on that? If you're there. Anyways, there's a posting that if you wanted to look more into that, you'd go Google Bill C-21. But Stacey Corvo, if you're really interested in pursuing what's happening on that front as far as what kinds of new legal structures we could have in Canada, she'd be the person to go to. She's based in B.C., at the
now I'm trying to unmute. I don't know if you can hear me now.
I can hear you now.
Oh yay!
That's Stacy.
It is.
Okay, you can talk yourself then. Go ahead.
So I'm not the only person doing it. Stig and Mars are definitely leaders in this area, but I am a bit of a structural nerd. So if you have, if anybody out there has any questions, you can definitely contact me, or if you go to centerforsocialenterprise.com, you will see 3 of our latest papers there. And if you register for our e-blast, then you will receive links to all of the other papers that the other leaders in the sector are creating. There seems to be a real critical mass that's just sort of a tipping point that's come out of nowhere over the past few months, and suddenly specific provincial governments are interested in learning more, and they really seem to be taking our work seriously.
Great. Thanks, Stacey. Okay, we've about 11 minutes. So are there any questions from the floor right off the hop? And if there are, if you could unmute your line, star 6, state your name, location.
I have a question. It's Tom Bergbusch at the Rural Cooperative Secretary, but if somebody else wants to go before me, I'm quite happy to let them go, but I just want to register that I have a question to ask.
No, you go ahead. First come, first serve.
Okay. I'm very interested in this this debate, which I have followed for a few years now. And there's a lot of emphasis put, once again, on getting institutional investors, among some of your speakers, to divert a portion of their funds to social enterprise or community development activities. In the past, very often, however, when different groups have gone to them, they've said, not unreasonably, that it was their fiduciary responsibility not to look at small investment vehicles or alternative investment vehicles, but to maximize the returns at all times for Canadians. Now, in view of the recent downturn, which has affected pensions, and also has affected social enterprises in the UK, and is starting to put lots of community banks who do this kind of investment in the states in danger. What reason is there for us to believe that the model of extending the market financing to community finance is in fact the way to go? Wouldn't it be better to focus on the one hand on developing community savings and solidarity savings, and on the other on a return to a greater system of redistribution directly to organizations?
Thank you. That was Tom, right? Tom?
Yes.
Any of the speakers could respond if you'd like.
I can comment on that. In my recommendation, this is George, obviously. You don't need caller ID for me. But in my recommendations, I touched on all of those. Like community savings is great. This is what we rely on in Nova Scotia with the CDF program. But there have been quite a few business people here in Nova Scotia that have medium-sized companies with capital reserves that express interest in investing in bigger amounts in the social economy. I know it doesn't sound right, but slow money is a new thing now, and people are prepared to take a lower dividend and with some security. And basically, that's the same kind of a thing that Paul Martin spoke about back in the fall, and he's been referenced in the Global Mail article 2 weeks ago. That if there were tax savings, tax advantage, in a big way, something like you will give to the junior companies, the junior exploration companies looking for oil or looking for minerals, is the same kind of tax regime was available for investments in social enterprise and social economy. They will be prepared to do that. And the thing is, when we're looking for huge amounts of money for expansion, like I mentioned, 42% of the social economy organizations were looking for over $500,000 to expand. This kind of money is a little bit difficult to get on from small investors. Some sophisticated investors that have money, a lot of money, they're prepared to take those kind of risks. And the small investors, they usually come in with small amounts of money, and it takes a little bit more time to build the community savings. Obviously, we're in CD, so we believe in CD, but I think we could tap both.
Thanks, George. Any other comments from the other speakers?
It's Jessica. I agree with George that it's important for it to be an option because there are investors who are interested. And certainly the growing corporate social responsibility movement, regardless of what people might think of how that's used or what it is, tells us that there are certainly other avenues to pursue in terms of recruiting more investors in the social economy sector and finding reasons that will be compelling for them in terms of investing. So I would say that it's growing in importance in terms of building these opportunities because the interest is growing, whether it's in traditional or non-traditional ways.
Great. Thanks, Jessica. Do we have another question? That was a good question. Thanks, Thomas. No?
I could ask another question if people like.
Yeah, and when you, I just wanted to make a comment regarding the when you were talking about the institutional investors and fiduciary responsibility and the need to diminish risk and this idea of having a broker. I think one of the speakers spoke about it, an intermediary that basically does that work. Would that not help in that effort?
I think my sense is that there could potentially be a benefit for that, but it would have to be shown to be genuine, right? I mean, such a broker would have to be able to demonstrate they can fly it on its own two feet, not necessarily with special government subsidies, for it to make sense in terms of government spending. But I'm a bit more concerned about the cyclical nature of this kind of finance, which dries up suddenly in recessions, and I worry that it's something which is too devoted to extending market or private sector finance makes the can put pressure on social investments, so social enterprises, because of the cyclical declines in financing that they may face.
Okay, so that's a comment. Anybody want to follow up on that?
Well, that's cyclical nature, I think. This is George. That's cyclical nature, I think we see this everywhere. I mean, private investors climb up to, it's definitely, it definitely has its risk and it's got its rewards. And I think if the sector is diversified and it looks for financing from all avenues, that's only going to help the stability of supply of finance. If we have both community-based and private-based suppliers, I think that will just make more sense if we're more diversified. Like I mentioned, Quebec has done well by including the labor movement in it also, and basically they have a partnership that covers the whole society.
Can I just comment? It's Mary, and I guess it depends on the way you look at it. Like when we are thinking about these financing models, we're looking at it from a very national, global perspective, and we are talking about proposals for different types of financial tools. And this is just it's just one avenue. And so, as long as you have various different types of tools in the marketplace, and at least in the social marketplace, it gives it a more diversity. And I think that it's not just uncommon in what we're trying to start to build, but
I just a comment on the cyclical nature. I agree with George. I mean, this is for large expansion. Sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. I think the fact that you have a combination of financing is important. If we just look back at the foundations, quite a few foundations cut back. You know, if they were giving two a year, they also cut back to one intake or applicant application. And I can speak to our local community foundation. So that type of thing is going to happen in the marketplace. And I don't know that's a huge, huge problem. Any other questions or comments? We've got 4 minutes left.
Yes, it's Walter Hosley at Momentum. Seth, good to hear your voice.
Yes, you too, Walter.
I'm wondering, the two researchers, particularly George and the woman that looked at Quebec, sorry, I can't remember her name, could you speak to what the sector looks like? In my mind, it includes co-ops, charities, and potentially quasi-non-governmental organizations. When we talk about the sector's scope and size as a whole, how many of the people you researched, George, were actually charities or entities versus co-ops and so forth? How does that picture change in Quebec?
Well, we used for our study, we used the Quebec definition. So basically, all of the people we surveyed, all the organizations we surveyed, they did have some trading activity. Now, some of them had charitable status also, and they operated this as a, they had a social enterprise and charity status at the same time. But primarily, co-ops will be the ideal kind of, you know, that's the model kind of social economy organization for us. So all co-ops, even worker co-ops, are included in our sample. No government agencies. That was one of the key things, that we don't have any government agencies.
So hospitals, community clinics.
No, we did not include hospitals in ours or community colleges or universities.
What about community futures organizations?
If they had trading activity, we included them. But no, we didn't have any. In my sample, we didn't come across any of them. We don't have them here we didn't have any.
What's your definition of a trading activity?
Like they sell something. They have some kind of and it's not donations. So they're actually selling something.
It could be a government training contract.
It could be a government training contract. Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But but it's income. It's not a grant.
Okay.
As long as they're delivering a service or a good, and they're bringing in something, that's basically the Quebec definition. That's what we use.
Okay. And what about the definition of grant?
Grant, it could be any federal or provincial government grant that it didn't require them to perform a service. You know, a trading. They were providing social service, but not a trading service.
Okay, I've got 1 minute left, so I'm going to have to close it down probably. Walter, I'm sorry. Hopefully that gave you some answers to the questions you had. I just wanted to, in the last minute, thank all those who participated. I'm not sure what the count was, but I think it's a good kickoff to this series. The next one, I believe, is next Wednesday, and it's on procurement, which I think it was mentioned in the discussion today as an important piece of creating revenues for social enterprises. So hopefully you guys can look at that as an option for next week. Thanks a lot to all the speakers, Mary, Jessica, and George, and to the FedNet and to the Canadian Social Economy Hub for hosting and partnering to enable this to happen. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the platform.
Thank you.
Thank you.